Button?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very difficult to remain relaxed in that state.
Well, we don't have bhajan chairs. You should make your own bhajan chair. A bhajan chair is a supportable chair in which you can...
But even when you've got your...
But here is nature's own bhajan chair. This is nature's own bhajan chair. You're in the womb already. Unless you entered the womb, can't be born again. So hatha yoga is still the same thing. And Jesus can tell you, sit down in this position and move with the bhajan. See, because this is the womb state. The fetus is being formed in this state, and the polarity is here already. And since you're going back to the sankara, the baby here is in sankara all the time. It's born in cosmic consciousness when it comes up. Because it's formed in cosmic consciousness. And we just lose it from the time we get solved in our mouth. That's a bad deal we have with it. People busy trying to push baby food in your mouth and it's got salt, and about the end of it, it cuts off the energy. Short circuited. The hand here can stay for a long time, right? But you may not be able to sit like this for a long time because of it not being accustomed. So the ideal situation is to get a cushion and come on that position to see the light, for example. See, because then the hand is supported properly. So you can put a cushion the whole time. Now, we used to have a tea bar. You can make a tea bar. You go in the hardware store and buy one of those screw type legs. You know, it has a little, its own bracket. And he wanted to meet me. So we met. And then he began to ask about astral projection, if I could do astral projection. He says, no, I don't know how to do astral projection. So, what are you teaching? I said, all I teach is meditation. Okay. So he says, you don't mind if I astral project in the room? I says, no, I don't mind. So we close our eyes, and he astral project all over the room. But then the funniest thing was this. When the meditation was all over, he says, where did you go? I couldn't even find you in the room. He says, I knew your physical body was there, but he says, all I saw from the time you closed your eyes, a light like a firefly left your forehead and it's gone. He says, and I look all at your body all the way through, there's nothing there. He says, where did you go? I said, well, I don't astral project, and you do astral projection. And his astral body is all over the room, 13. Now this is the difference between astral projection and learning to go out through the sun current. The sun current is the audible life stream that connects you to the life principle in the universe. And as you are locked into it, this is what initiation is all about. Initiation is to lock you into the sun current so that when you close your eyes, it winds you in. Now, Jesus uses certain terms in his lectures to his people, but they are not understood by the people. Come, I will make you fishers of men. Now, when a fisherman throws his rod out, he has a bait at the end, right? And what does the fish do? It bites the bait. But is the fisherman worried if the bait and the fish start pulling? What does he actually do after it bites? He just allows it to wear itself out, right? Then when it wears itself out and gets tired, the fish cannot get into the basket or into the frying pan by itself. It just ain't no way. All he's done, hook himself by the gill or in the mouth, and there he is. And eventually, the fisherman takes his time and reels the fish in and put them in the basket or the pot or put it in the frying pan. This is the principle of the sankaran by initiation. From the time you're initiated, it's hooked into you at the right side of the brain. That current is hooked in. And you are just that little fish at the end of the master's fishing pool. You ain't going no place. So you, what are you kidding me? Worrying about? You're not going to let you go away. So either you end up in this frying pan, that means the karma comes more faster, you know? Or you put you in the bucket where the water is and you float around and swim around. Take the hook out of your mouth. So but he reels you in. This is the difference between astral projection and going in the inner life stream through the samkaran. The moment a person is initiated and he hears the samkaran, does the bhajan or does the simran, he is reeled in. That's why you hear it like a reel, it pulls it like a reel. And you are connected to it like a fish on a hook. In reality, on the actual end of the scale of the true world energy, this is what is really happening to you. This is the whole ocean of Maya. And the Son of God is a fisherman. He's only going to catch the allotted fish. That's the one that's going to bite the hook. That's the one that's going to be initiated, that feels the need to go inward. So he throws out the bait. The bait is what you call initiation. It's bobbing there. And we may be gullies, or we may be guppies, or buffalo fish, or wolf fish, or sheep fish. You clap on the bait and the pull. You've been told he looks what he look like, or what you think he's supposed to look like. But it's your own self who put it there. He didn't put himself there. God is life. Positive and negative. He is in you. And you dress up the negative with masks and call them devils. And you dress up the positive and you call them angels or God. We do this to ourselves. The supreme life power has no form. Only expression it has is a radiant light. And when you look very intensely in that light, all you can see is your own self. It's like a mirror of what you are. And your whole self is divine oneness, a diamond body. It's luminous. Is non-sexual. There is no male, there is no female in it. So, yet, within that light, every color of the universe is there. So you can one moment see yourself as black, yellow, green, purple, indigo, and all the shades of it multiply to the nth degree. So you see, it's very entertaining. And one moment you don't like your fandango, you wear a gypsy rose in your lip. I mean, you do, you know. Next time you don't like that, when you put on your queue, don't you like that, then you run with your rickshaw. If you don't like that particular scene of yourself, you dress up like, what's his name, Eric the Red or Gertie, and you give yourself all kind of roles in that light.
That is mind-wandering, that is insane.
No, this is just the reviewing of what you have done through the world time of living life. It's you. It's a marvelous experience to see yourself in all these roles. It's gone. It's all gone. But it's not hallucinating, though. It's happening to us all inside. It's the pure light.
Is that what you mean when you say that you remember everything?
Yeah. You remember everything that a human mind can dream up. It's quite a trip. Believe me. You know, one time I wrote Yogananda and I asked him, I says, could you please recommend a book for me to read? After getting initiated in meditation techniques and I've been studying for nearly 2 years, I would like to have a book to read that you could recommend, you know. It's, after all, the master should know some good books. And he replied, he says, the largest library in the world, he says, is located right between your two eyes. You can spend all eternity trying to read it. That night when I closed my eyes, I saw a big book No kidding. Because you hold Akashic records and the page is open, all in white and gold, and the letters were there in images. And there's a big brown hand, and I can remember him, he used to wear a wristwatch, he had a gold wristwatch, and a long pointer, and I can hear his voice. Now, the origin of creation. And you get lost. When you come out, you think you've only been there for a few seconds, you've been there for a heck of a long time. You see yourself going through the whole life stream from little thought right down into the bugs and everything. You find out pretty soon where you are. You know, you don't. Ego goes away pretty fast because you find that you don't have to, none in there. You know, it's very interesting to see yourself a worm crawling along the ground, and all of a sudden something plucks you by your neck. And when you look up, there's a sparrow. Hey, buddy, give me a break. What for? I gotta lift it. What do you mean, give you a break? I gotta lift it. You're necessary for my survival. Yeah, but I got family to feed to. I gotta look for some maggots. No such deal. Time up. Book of Life shows you where you are. Next time you're flying like a bird through the sky, free. Bam! You look in your chest and there's an arrow. Hey, what happened? Some young man down there dressed up in little feathers all over, he's got to eat. And you're the nice little bird that came down with the arrow in your chest. And the roles play is a fantasy of yourself in this live stream. And you find out that all is God. God is playing all these roles in himself. And he's using the human body as a movie screen to entertain himself. See? This is the whole thing about it. The whole universe is all locked up in us. The whole of creation, past, present, future, is all locked up in us. And you go in and out. And the one thing you learn is that life is eternal. And personality or ego is like waves on it. These are the roles. These are the different masks you put on. Either one time you're a woman, one time you're a man. You're playing different roles inside. You wake up from the dream. That's why the poet says life is all but an empty dream. When you wake up from the dream, but waking up from the dream is that you don't dream no more. That's the real realization, that you stop dreaming for the first time. Then when you stop dreaming and you go deeper into the meditation, you can dream what you want to dream. In other words, whatever you visualize inside can become a reality outside. This is the real process of the spiritual life. So the saint, he does not interfere with the karma because the karma is all dreams. To shift one karma to correct one problem for an individual, because the individual is unable to break the dream, is not getting rid of the karma, it's just monitoring it. So he dreams the dream that is ideal for the soul, so the soul does not feel that it is imprisoned by the karma. He dreams this particular dream for the individual, for the disciple. He sets the dream state for the disciple to become dreamless, to become at peace with himself. Because the master is in a dreamless state. But he can dream what dream you want and need. We have an example like that in Babaji. You remember in the autobiography of a yogi, Lahiri Mayasha, in a past life, some way along there, he must have looked at some palace, possibly might have looked at Akbar the Great, you know, living in sumptuous palace all by himself, and said to himself, man, he's got it good. I wish I had something like that. And he's outside there shouting, ah, for the love of Allah. And then looks up and see the big, huge Mughal emperor in his castle. Well, he might have thought of it. And he was daydreaming to satisfy that dream, since he could not bring that dream into reality for himself. Babaji dreamed the dream for him by crystallizing it. And then he initiated him inside of it, so that knocks out the dream desire. No? So when he walks around and he picks up the beautiful stones and look at the stone from the world's value, each stone must be worth a few rupees, you know, and everything. But he's thinking it's a dream. And then his friend tells him, another disciple tells him, no, it's real. Everything you see here is real. It's valid. 100%, they'll stand all the tests. The only one problem is held together by the will of the master. That is telling the student now, the master knows how to dream the dream. And as soon as the master releases his will from the atoms that are real, the atoms will disperse back into their sphere of emotion. Now, Lahiri then gave up the desire. See, he gave up the desire to live in a castle. And by giving up the desire to live in the castle, he gave up the attachment. Then he was free. Now, being free from the desire and attachment, he then gained the power to dream the dream. So when he came down, this is what a realized man has now, the ability to crystallize the thoughts of others, to dream the dream. They don't dream their own dreams no more. They have no more dreams. They're all over. He can only dream the dream of the student who needs something to dream about or want, and cause that to crystallize. So they have a relationship. So when he came down, he told some friends that he had met a great saint up in the mountains. He said, oh, nonsense. He says, well, if I call him, he will come. Hallucinations. Okay, give me a room. So he gets in the room and he starts to dream the dream. And there is Babaji materialized to him. But Babaji says to him, why do you call me? He says, Master wanted to show these people that you do exist. He says, they don't believe because until they see. He says, but I wouldn't let your word go amiss and make you out a liar. I'll appear and let them see that I do exist and I'm not a dream in the ordinary sense of the word. He is a cosmic dreamer, right? But superstar dreams. But he came out and he asked for them to prepare food, halva, which is, and serve it. And they ate, and he ate with them. Then, before their very eyes, he dispersed his atoms for them to see. The dream of how to dream a dream. This is what the masters are. They go back by their own will, their own volition, not by compulsion of karma. But then, Lahiri was denied the right. He told Lahiri after, he says, I will no longer come when you want me. See, that would be ego. But when you need me, that is survival, divine will. So when he did need the master came to him all the time. But when he wanted the master wouldn't come. He had to learn that lesson. And at a later date, he had an opportunity to demonstrate that to himself, between the want and the need. One day he's sitting down in his room with his disciples, talking about God. And then his wife came in after the disciples had gone and started quarreling with him and says, you spend so much time with your students, you don't even spend time with me, and you don't even provide enough food for us in the house. You're always constantly giving away everything. And all of a sudden, he's no longer sitting in the room. He's gone. And here she is, a woman with her husband. She knows her husband. And where has he gone? He didn't walk out of the door. He suddenly vanished into thin air. And she started crying, my husband, where are you? My guru, where are you? And he says, here I am. And she looks up. There he's floating in the roof. He said to her, "How can you expect spirit to provide material things? I'm spirit. Nothing else here. This is all a dream. Material matter is a dream. But don't worry. One of my spiritual sons will leave you some finances when I'm gone." She was more concerned with the solidity of things. And then she realized that her husband was not a solid being in the first place. He appeared solid. That was a dream to her. But then she saw the dream that he dreamed and went into that state, which gave her the shock of her life. But then she came out of that dream state. She no longer dreamed such dreams no more. Then she was able to dream the dream that one can dream. Meditation is to help us to break this illusion of dreaming. That's why Casey says your spiritual growth begins with dreams and ends in dreams. But most people don't understand what he's talking about either. It starts with the hallucinatory level. Then it goes to where there are no dreams. Then it becomes a reality level where you're capable of dreaming at will for the first time what you want to dream. It's called by the masters the ability to visualize and crystallize other desires. Christ consciousness. It's the gift of Christ consciousness. Christ consciousness has no magic. It only has one power: to materialize thought at will. And it doesn't materialize your own thoughts. It's not a person, it's the force field within you that crystallizes the desires of those around you who have a karmic bond with you. And that is the way it works. I can look forward to you for a copy, but I have no copy. Even if I forgot to copy it, must be a reason. Now, anytime you say this piece of food tastes lousy, that's matter. You see, every time you curse it, it comes back home to roost. We don't begin to realize that we ourselves are creating karma by the very things we're using. And you said, "This lousy fire don't burn too good." How many times we say these things to ourselves? "It's not hot enough." And then we said, "The air is sticky and stuffy. You can't breathe it." Then finally, we shout to the top of our voices to impress others. That's ego, using up the thought waves. These are all forces that must go on in us. And outside of the human skin, this body here on this side of the surface, these five forces are in conflict. Tremendous battle going on here. On the other side, the skin, inside of the human body, it enclosed, they're in constant harmony and union. Now we are the only ones that can block it, and that is by ego. So the five forces do govern us as long as we live and exist. And they govern us by greed, which is the material aspect of us in the human body. Then they govern us by lust, which is the water aspect in the body. Then they govern us by anger, which is the fire aspect in the body. And they govern us by attachment, which is the air aspect of the body. And finally, it governs us by ego, which is energy going out of us in the form of ether in the body. See, ego is energy going out in the centrifugal movements all the time, ejecting. And humility is energy coming in centripetally to the center, centering back, be here now. That's devotion. The same ego going backwards now in itself is becoming devotion. And when it goes out, it's centrifugal. See? It's throwing itself up in centrifuge, away from the center. Now the disciplines are very simple to control these five forces. They are the disciplines laid down by all the saints and masters of the world. who have mastered that steam. And one is for greed, nutrition. And since nutrition is important to our life, we follow solar nutrition. We eat the fruits that grow on the trees in the morning, vegetables that grow above the ground in the middle of the day, and some of the fruits that grow on the ground at evening time, afternoon time, and food that grow under the ground at night. That is the basic discipline. By the way, they are grown through their archetypal pattern and their response to the light. We synchronize to that. And this is what Jung is saying. Until we learn to synchronize with the environment, we cannot have inner peace. And that means balancing all forces in ourselves. And synchronization must coincide with the natural movements that are there. So if plants are designed to grow high off the ground, like your apples, by this creative intelligence, if you plant an apple in China, it's certainly you're not going to pick the fruit out from under the ground. You take that apple and fly it all the way to Peru and plant it, you'll never find it under the ground. You're still going to be on top of a tree, because that's the way it was designed, to grow above the ground and have the rays of the light at a certain time. So you eat the fruit in the morning by their structural pattern, their archetypal pattern, and their life movement by sunlight. That should be the normal eating of the food to govern the greed. And those that grow on the surface, again, if you plant squash, you're not going to find it on top of the tree hanging down. If you plant cabbage, it's certainly not going to find it on the tree either. So their location and their growth pattern is archetypally set up. So the time of the day is in the middle of the day. And there is fruit also for the middle of the day, like your melons and cantaloupe. That is in solar nutrition. You're following the solar pattern. And in the evening time, before you go to bed, the foods that grow under the ground. So if you plant carrots in China, or you plant it in India, or Africa, or the United States, you can find them still under the ground. And in no way, shape, or form, they're crawling on top of trees. That's the way they grow. Like the woman who asked me, she said, well, I've never seen a peanut. How does it grow? Can I eat it in the morning? I said, no, it grows under the ground. Well, what? The peanut grows under the ground. I said, yes, it doesn't grow on trees. She didn't know that peanut didn't grow on trees. And there's a story, a true story that happened here in Georgia. When the peanut came out in the time of George Carlin, when he started to introduce it to the American public, a fellow sold out his clothing store in New York and came down to Georgia and bought up a whole peanut patch and was going to go into peanut to compete with planters. And there was a Georgian farmer who sold him the land, and he spent hundreds of dollars to plant the whole field. And at the end of the year, when the crop was supposed to come in, there was no peanuts on the trees. So he's very despondent, a whole barren field. So he's bankrupt. So he comes back to the farm, he says, hey, what happened? You sold me a bad set of seeds that don't produce. The farmer looked at him and says, well, I'll tell you what. Since there are no plants in it, and since you've been paying me a small amount for the land, I'll tell you what, I'll give you back your money. And I'll use the whole thing for sheep and goat and cow and let them eat up. That way you won't lose nothing. So the fellow took back his money and went back to New York. And 2 weeks after, who did he see? up in New York, the peanut brittle, the farmer. Because the farmer knew that the peanut was under the ground. But this was a true story that happened in Georgia. The peanut brittle came from that. The man actually plowed up all the peanuts and mixed it in with cane sugar and made peanut brittle and shipped it to New York. But it grows under the ground, and I was a kid, you know, we never called it peanut where I grew up. We used to call it monkey nut or groobage. That's the name we call it, monkey nut or groobage. You go get them in the ground. Rub in the ground, right? Pick it up. But they're ideal to be eaten at night. So we govern greed by nutrition. Now how do we govern lust? It is of course of the water element. By the married life. And maintaining yourself through an occupation. Therefore we govern lust. And lust is not necessarily sex alone. The lust for life, the lust for thing, the possessiveness of it. This is governed by a normal relationship with another human being. And that way you govern lust. Anger, we govern by not using alcohol to retain the equilibrium of the brain. Otherwise the brain loses its equilibrium. And when you get deeper into the simran and the meditation, the bhajans, the gyroscopic action of the brain can be thrown off its course if you use alcohol. It will throw the brain off its course and wouldn't center directly on the life energy. So you can control anger by not using alcohol. Attachment is controlled by not using drugs to hallucinate the brain. Otherwise the brain will lose the willpower from the drugging, and therefore it will become attached to a material possession by the form of security. It tranquilizes and deadens the nerve end. When we use the drug, we fracture the auric web, and thus we make ourselves susceptible to entities of the lower realm, earthbound entities, and we become mediumistic, and that floods into our system. So we can be obsessed or possessed by entities. Also, we turn off the life energy in the cells. After the drug is administered to the cells, they lose their glow. They become waxy. They don't have that glow no more. It takes about 8 to 10 years to restore that balance by proper nutrition. And it has a tendency to drain the energy. Also, it changes the auric field. Now, in the act of sex, if we perform sex outside of marriage, in true rape, the aura is black. And the child can be born distorted from the act of violence. Because the whole body convulses, and it's a clear principle. The ovum and the sperm will go into convulsions in rape. The offspring can be distorted. If it's performed outside of marriage, then the conscience comes into play. The aura is gray-green. The fear of retribution or rebuke from the parent or the resentment of society and its mores and ideas sets up the pattern. And therefore, the thought waves of those who look upon us performing the act outside of marriage tends to build a shield or an auric barrier around the child. And that child also can be born distorted or deformed. Now when the act is performed in marriage, or after marriage. This is where the scripture says these two people have become one flesh before man and God. It's not marriage, it's not man-made. It's a God-made principle. By open declaration, by open consent, by open acceptance. The aura is pink. And the thought forces of those who are concentrating forms like a moon around the couple. And that moon is a color of honey. That's where they got the concept of honeymoon. Those who can really see the aura around the person at the time and the friends who are genuinely interested in the married couple, sending their thought waves around that couple, they will see this moon of light surrounding them. It's the blending of the two forces of the sun and the moon, of the two lights in their body, becoming one, because the soul is ambidextrous and androgynous. It is bipolar. So it's no male female. It's these two becoming one for the first time. Only when breath came into the nostril did the soul split by virtue of reaction. And in the first act of sex in creation did the soul separate and become male and female. Because the soul is bisexual. But in marriage, this is permitted because it is said God looked down upon man and saw him alone, and it was not right for him to be alone. Therefore, he made him a helpmate. That was the second manifestation of man. The first manifestation of man was, come, let us make man in our own image and likeness, male and female created him. So we have two creations. The first creation of man, where male and female were released out of the pure stream of life. And the second creation of man is the polarities of the body when the soul separates. That's called the Adam and Eve principle. Now, the sex act in marriage is accepted by all saints or masters, and even Jesus will say, when these two people have become one flesh, let no man separate them, let no man interfere. No holds barred, that's their life, this is how they can live, this is their freedom. Now, that is love at its purest form. Now, we come back to a peculiar phenomenon in the scriptures. Adulteration or adultery, that we assume in our minds is the act of sex outside of marriage from your own personal married partner. But the Master Jesus never said that, because when they found a woman and brought her to him by virtue of the law in those days performing the act of sex outside of marriage, she was supposed to be stoned to death. She was an adulteress. Alright? He took up a stone, which is the normal lethal weapon to kill the person, and offered it to them, and said, he who is without sin, let him cast the first stone. And everybody looked and backed off, because their conscience began to tell them that they themselves did not understand what adultery really meant. And then when they were all backed off, he says to the woman, I see none of your accusers. Go do it no more. Now, then he was asked by his disciples, if a man can get along with his wife, should he give her a bill of divorce? And then he said, yes, but also thou committest adultery. But what is this adultery? He says, to merely look at the person is to commit adultery. That's a pretty harsh statement. He's not talking of the sex act. He's talking of a different principle. The adulteration of one's consciousness by leaving the audible life current, which is identified with you and your partner at the time of your marriage. That this was supposed to fuse and give both of you God realization. You're supposed to come back into that state of oneness. And if you leave that state, you are adulterating. Now, In the country where I come from, there used to be a law passed there. It's called the $9 law for adulterated milk. If you find you selling milk and you add too much water to stretch it to make more money, the inspector would come along and fine you $9. This is because it's called adulterated milk. Pure milk, they stretch it off from the cow right away and they examine it, its content and everything. And adulteration is to add 4 parts of water to make it 4 times more. So for every gallon, the people used to get 4 gallons of milk by adding 4 parts of water. And they go around and sell it. But they got away with it for a while until the city people start inspecting the milk. That was adulteration, weakening it up. And it was called adulteration, adulterated milk. The same thing is true in consciousness. When we weaken it by deviating from that point, this is the adulteration of the energy. We are separating ourselves from the outer apparent. So to control lust, which is a form of adulteration, we practice the normal married life. This is why the masters, they're all married. The real genuine masters are all married. They don't renounce. That is to keep the balance so there is no internal adulteration of consciousness towards the life current. Now they maintain that association, and until they're married, they maintain their personal identity with themselves. The aura is pink in that state when the act is performed in sex. Now, how is a master to be born? We find all masters are born in homes of married people, and especially if they're initiates. You'll never find a master born in a home of a non-initiate. You can trace them all. Every master that's been born, every realized master that has been born from the Lord of the soul, I don't mean from the Lord of creation, are born in the home of an initiate. For example, Paramahansa Yogananda had many brothers and sisters. His first brother and sister were born before him. But they were not the children of parents who were initiates, because his parents were not initiated at the time when they were born. At a later date, when the father was working and had a man work with him, wanted to go and see his teacher to get darshan, that is to see the teacher get the magnetic pole, he told this to the workman, "Why are you going to be a religious fanatic?" But the man kept repeating his simran, doing his japa, and eventually that afternoon, to console the man, because he turned him down, right across the paddy field, he saw the teacher materialize in the air and said to him, "Why are you so hard on my student?" That made him go now with the intent to see this teacher who would appear and intercede. When he arrived at their house, he got the same message. And then he was accepted and initiated, and he began to practice his meditation. Then the child that was born after the initiation was Yogananda. Now he grew up and his father initiated him. He was initiated by his father. Also he was initiated by his Sanskrit teacher. And he was initiated by a few other Swamis. But they were not his Satguru. The one individual who will give him the final push, hit him in the tuchus and send him inside to heaven. You know, give him the final slap or pull him by the ear and say, "Come on, boy, and here's where you're going to go. Push your head in the ground and really wake you up." The Satguru is the one who gives you the same technique. He's not giving you no new technique, but he's the only one who's got the final way to kick you in, because you're being prepared by the rest for that last contact. So many of us are on our way in the process to the Satguru, see? But they have to go by initiation. So we are drawn to that state in initiation. Now, the last principle to master is ego. And we can only master ego now by meditation. And we must know the techniques of meditation. And this is given at initiation, or orientation of your mind. See, the word initiation means to introduce. To introduce you back to your life energy. To orientate you back to it. So, you are oriented to it for the first time. And lined up, center it. And you begin to master the ego, that is the energy that goes out of you. E-G-O, you know, it's E, it should be spelled E-G-O, the outgoing energy. You center it back. And the only way you can center it back or pull it back into a centripetal condition is by simmering or hallowing the name of the Lord and by hearing the sun currents and seeing the light. So it moves to a vortex, it moves into like a funnel, pours into the center of you, it comes back in. This is the way we harness the ego and discipline it. And 2.5 hours is the required amount of time per day we're supposed to meditate, which is approximately 1/10 portion of 24 hours. 2 hours and 40 minutes is the exact.
Getting these together and trying to prepare myself to just eat grain. Yeah. Food will keep indefinitely. They check food in there for at least 12 years. It's just as good as the day they put it in. There are companies that were out in California that specialize in dehydrated foods. So Dan and I ate a dinner served from these foods, and very palatable. The banana flakes, the carrot flakes, the dried peas, we like to pick up and eat as they were. Mixing them with water or preparing them in any way. However, when you eat dried foods, and incidentally this is true of raisins, prunes, you should always soak them until they're plump and soft. Otherwise, you pull too many of the tissue fluid juices out into the digestive tract and out of the body, and it's good for you. The fellowship is going to be stockpiling, gathering these foods in a cooperative manner for any of you who are interested. Dan and I have brought back 60 of these buckets with us. We've ordered 300 more sent out here for people who wish to get them. What else do you want me to say about that?
The types of grains that should be stored.
Save his voice for a while here. One needs to get certain types of grains on hand that can be sprouted to provide fresh vegetable type foods. These grains are wheat, oats, rye, buckwheat, alfalfa seed, fenugreek seed, sunflower seed, mung beans, well, other beans too, but mung beans will give you far more sprouts per pound than any other beans. We visited Ann Wigmore's place in Boston, Massachusetts this spring, where they have been working with these sprouts, these grains, for many, many years. Ann Wigmore is approaching 70, and she's just a bundle of energy and vitality. And she lives on 25 cents of raw food, worth of raw foods a day. That's what her foods cost her. Foods kept under a pyramid will another man in other ways. Most probably, I'm sure, have heard something of the queer man and what it can do, and particularly keeping razor blades sharp, things like that. But it also can serve to keep foods viable and able to sprout after years and years. See, most times sheep will not do this because of the cycles that they're accustomed to and the light coming and going, but kept in dark, in containers where they're in the darkness and kept under the pyramid of the right construction, the right proportions, they will keep for years and years. And Anna will be getting more of this information from time to time. The dimensions on the pyramid, we're going to build pyramids here. We advise all of you to make some arrangements. Even if you do not need the food within, say, the next 5 years, you at least will have had the experience, will be able to get things together, learn how to use them, learn how to prepare yourself, and so that you won't be caught short. Remember in the Bible the story of Joseph in Egypt? The Egyptians prepared for 7 years. They were told, several years ahead of time, because they didn't build these places just overnight to keep these things. They were told to get ready, and then there were 7 years of plenty. They took this extra food and stored it, and then there were 7 years when the crops failed. They had to supply people from many hundreds of miles around them to come to Egypt to buy food. Pretty much the same condition is going to develop all over the world. We don't know just what conditions this comet will bring as far as weather, food growing conditions, and so on are concerned, but many people are noticing tremendous changes, and they don't know just exactly what to expect in many respects. Any questions you have in mind that you want to ask?
Did you say a comet?
Yes. Are you not aware that there is a comet approaching?
No.
There is. They expect it to be quite close. This is November even.
Well, there were other comets before.
Yes. This one is a little bit different, though. They're quite concerned about its course, as far as they can determine it. We're coming exceedingly close to the Earth.
When is it expected to pass?
I don't know the exact date.
This year?
Yes, November. As far as I can determine, isn't that true?
Yeah, it's between November to December. They'll come within the sphere of the Earth. Pretty close. And the Earth only has 110 miles gravitational defense field before we enter what is called a weightlessness field. So if the Halley's Comet came within 800 miles of that defense field way back in time and caused a great deal of commotion on this Earth, we don't know how close this particular comet will come within that field of 110 miles from the surface. It will be about November to December, and we don't know exactly what distance it will come within the defense field of the Earth gravitational pull. The Earth gravitational pull has 110 miles protection that keeps it away from other objects. Past 110 miles, we are on a free flow. Everything is moving there in a weightless state. Now, in the time of Halley's Comet, the comet came about 800 miles close to the Earth's surface. So how the effect at that time was on the Earth, we have a great many of incidences to check it out. How close this comet will come within the proximity of the Earth, we don't know. It may come 400, 500 miles close to the Earth's surface. The closer it comes, the more reaction we have.
If it passes 110 miles and come in to this sphere, then it will crash into the Earth. This is the danger. The danger of crashing into us. Now, how big it is to damage us, we don't know that. But what we do know is that it's heading on a collision course. Modifications are already being made and seen on the sun. And a big bulge of light is already expanding on the sun because this is causing a magnetic field. So we will see if this collision course will crash or veer off by this sudden release of gases from the sun. This is due to occur anywhere around the end of November to December. Now, there's only one significant goodness about this particular planet impact with the comet, is that there will be an upsurge in the artistic nature in men, and a downsurge in the plant life, animal life, and an upsurge in insect life, and many other conditions that will tend to affect us in climate, weather, and relationships with each other. So we don't know what this situation will lead to by the end of November, December. The most significant thing that will happen, that animals will die suddenly with strange diseases. Insect life will increase, and we may have to use much more powerful insecticides. Plant life is going to suffer a great deal. The crops are going to suffer a great deal. So, what they're saying is, what is happening in terms of farming today, and in terms of prices, you can't afford to buy the food you want to buy at the price you wanted to buy it. And already our crops are pre-sold before they are grown or harvested in the ground. We don't have normal supplies or surpluses anymore. They've all been sold. And where we are farming today, we are farming strictly on contract basis already. So to feed a nation as large as this and to feed people who want to buy from us, we're going to run into a tremendous situation in a year or two from now. We don't realize it. The major chain stores are already on ration.
Far more beneficial than the way most water is nowadays.
this is something else one should have on hand, extra water. If you have not learned how to sprout grain seeds, you should learn to do so right away and have some means of doing so on hand. Get the body accustomed to eating them. Have a supply of oil on hand. Oil is one of the essential foods. Water, oils, proteins, starches, and sugars. Of course, the best sugar that one can have is honey. And a crystallized honey is, accelerated, has more effect on the body than the liquid honey. So let your honey crystallize. We're going to have dates, date sugar and things like that for sale pretty soon. Don't know just how much of that supply we can get ahead. But that, of course, is a very good sweet. And incidentally, dates, dried figs, have 1 pound of that has as much available protein for your body as 3 pounds of beef. We don't stop to think that that is true because these things are sweet, so we don't think of them as being protein, but they're very high-class protein. For months of my time, I survived on cultured goat milk and dates, occasionally a little almonds. They're very wonderful food, very nourishing. The more we stick to the foods that are more nearly a complete food and a very, very simple diet, it's very much easier for our body to handle. It takes far less energy to process these foods in the body. Therefore, we don't need to eat as many foods. The more we can simplify our diet and live on the natural foods in their natural states, the better off we'll be. Do you have any questions to thought on?
Did Halley's Comet have any effect on the Earth when it came within 800 miles?
Halley's Comet, see, is a recurring thing. There have been times in history when it has come closer than others, and it has had. The last few times, not any particular effect. That is, you know, in a devastating way. This comet seems to be rather unexpected. I've been sort of out of touch with things like that, not here lately, and I'm not too aware of it. Steve, do you?
Apparently this is not just a comet, but a fragment has about Grad Nebula. Not a reoccurring fragment, not an orbiting particle.
No, this is not a true comet in itself. This is actually a pulsar, a fragment of a pulsar. It's called a pulsar, heading from Crab Nebula. It has the speed of twice the speed of light. It's moving twice the speed of light. It's a broken Einstein theory to nothing now. That any object moving through space twice the speed of light will turn into energy, but this is not. Its condensed density is producing a weight twice the weight of the Earth. This has already been measured. Its weight is twice the weight of the Earth, and it's a very small fragment traveling through such space and coming towards us. How close it will get within the safety zone of our 110 miles, which is the proximity point for weightlessness. And if it makes a curve before that point, as the Earth moves in relation to the Sun, we may be pretty safe, but we don't know where it will make that curve. But she's due to make an impact within that proximity point in November, as we come in motion and line up with it. Now, if the line of motion sets her on a head-on collision, in November to December, she may head plow right into the Earth. But we don't know that yet, so it's coming towards us by then. But it does have tremendous significance in which it will affect by its magnetic waves, the plant life, the animal life, and the insect life. Now, when it comes in this close, it will always affect the waves of the ocean, tidal waves. It will affect our weather, and it will affect the brain waves of the human being. Yes?
How big is it compared to the Earth?
They say it is the size of a peanut, but having the density of twice the weight of the Earth. And traveling at twice the speed of light.
Like a bullet flying into an elephant. Sort of similar. But yeah, how powered life will bullet can utterly devastate an elephant. Sending a torpedo charge into a whale, something like
right.
that. Yes.
What has effect, and it's just soon, how come it has been made more public so people can anticipate it?
Have you ever seen Panic?
Yeah.
No. No. They don't want people to panic until they have to panic. I've seen Panic. You don't want to see it.
Who are they? You mean the government?
Yes.
Right.
Well, how did you get this knowledge? Was it just sort of leaked down?
A master's disciple. But what else?
But also it was published in the London Radio Observatory. The London Radio Observatory, you know, we have that large, big scope that measuring. The big air, they call it, that measures space in the Observatory of London. This picked it up already when the Crab Nebula burst and the pulsars began to be noticed. Then it began to notice one coming towards the Earth sphere. And this was put out already in over the last 6 months now in London. But they never knew it was heading on a collision course towards the Earth. They knew it was coming towards this sphere. But it's getting closer now as they begin to chart it. So it's heading towards us around November, December. But they've already measured its density, they measured its size, and they measured its velocity. And as my wife just said, it's like a bullet heading into an elephant. A bullet can kill an elephant. It doesn't need to take another elephant to kill an elephant. The velocity, the density of the thing can do a lot more to the object.
Would you like to sum up some of the psychological effects that it will have on the human race?
Panic, violence, the tremendous depression, melancholy.
What about what you said about the artistic nature of man?
The artistic nature will increase. That's the one significant goodness about it. Because the ratio of light that will hit us will stimulate the alpha wave of the brain.
What about physical symptoms?
Physical symptoms, there will be a great deal of irritability in the body and restlessness. And a tremendous amount of body getting hot, aggravated, the adrenals will start to heat up a lot. The slightest thing will irritate you, and you'll get into fits of anger.
During the retreat this past week, we've been studying the Psalms. The Psalms are designed to give us age via the angelic forces. Not forces, I shouldn't say that, are beings. These very wonderful beings who act in a way as transformers to step down this energy in creation. We couldn't take it straight. And these angels kept to, they draw it through themselves and then out into directed into some specific part of creation that's under their charge. Now one of the Psalms, the help in the times of natural catastrophes, such as tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, forest fires, and on-charging meteors, comets, and so forth. Now, I give you many instances of our personal use of these psalms, and the 149th psalm in particular. So if people will begin to use these great mantras, because these are what the psalms are. Some of these psalms were designed during the days of Egypt, perhaps even antedate Egypt. Remember, Moses was a prince of the ruling house of Egypt. The 108th psalm is verbatim from the inside one of the great pyramids, for instance. So, get familiar with the 149th psalm. Memorize it. Most of all, use it. Because we have to dig our ditches before it rains if we're going to impound any water and make use of it. So don't wait. Begin right now and generate a great force field of love around the planet Earth, in the heavens, so that these fellow travelers can get along at peace with one another. Any questions about that? The holy name of God, incidentally, used with that psalm is the one we call Jehovah. But don't try to say it. Print it and use it as a little marker on the lines as you read the psalm. Just impress it upon your brain very vividly. Chant Om before you use the psalm. Look at the holy name and impress upon the mind very clearly the reason for saying the psalm, to help bring peace in the solar system, to help, as I said, these two objects, to fulfill their karma for the highest spiritual good of all concerned, in accordance with perfect divine will. That's the best thing we could do. Remember when the angels came and said that Sodom and Gomorrah would be destroyed by fire from heaven, because of their wickedness, but if 10 righteous or right-thinking men could be found in those cities, they would not be destroyed. Well, they couldn't find 10 right-thinking men. So Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And when Nineveh's number came up, and Jonah was told to go to Nineveh, which was just as wicked as Sodom and Gomorrah, he found enough men there who would begin to change their attitudes, change their hearts, and who could set up this tremendous force field. So Nineveh was not destroyed. Found enough men there who would begin to change their attitudes, change their hearts, and who could set up this tremendous force field. So Nineveh was not destroyed. These things are for real. The Bible isn't telling fairy tales or little moral anecdotes. These were actual occurrences.
Thank you.
Should we say the psalm out loud?
Yes. Say it out loud to impress it upon the ears. See, the more of the senses that can become aware of these vibratory rates, the better it is. But later, as you begin to say it and you get into the rhythm of it, you won't want to say it out loud. However, at the time when a tornado was approaching and roaring overhead, sounding like dozens of freight trains, I got so lost in that psalm, I didn't care whether tornado hit at night, it can really do tremendous things, particularly in a time of great stress like that.
You see, the word psalm, as we write it today in English, is P-S-A-L-M. You went back to the original writing, it was P-S-I-A-L-M. But when you speak in English, you can't pronounce P-S-I-A-L-M. It don't sound right. Because two vowels coming together break the tone relationship. Now when you break the word up and see in the ancient Sanskrit, in the ancient Hebrew, how it was written, the metaphysical impact, P-S-I-A-L-M would be the correct word. Therefore, A-L-M means aid, arm. P-S-I would be extrasensory aid. Aid beyond the five senses. Why would one try to repeat words merely to gain protection if it had nothing to do with extrasensory forces? Parapsychical forces are constantly working around us to aid us. We don't want it because we think we are very smart, very elevated in consciousness. But these parapsychical forces work in spite of ourselves to protect us against ourselves. So we're going to be helped in spite of ourselves, even if we don't accept it. Some of us are going to be pushed along to be awakened in that state. So when we begin to look at the word psalm, we see now in these mantras, as they're called, or psalms, an extrasensory aid available to men by virtue of repetition. The science of it is in repetition and in conscious synchronization, whereby the vital life force in you, that vital life force in you is identified with the audible intonation of the sounds. So when you start out using the sound with your voice so that this hearing mechanism is impressed with it, then the mind in turn becomes synchronized. It becomes part of the bloodstream. The frequency is raised into life force. Thus the acceleration puts it in command over the energy. Now you have a manifestation of controlling matter by consciousness. Thereby we say we have produced a miracle, but we haven't produced a miracle. We merely learned to synchronize with the laws of nature and brought it into manifestation by virtue of love. We have to surrender ourselves into the process. So when we repeat the sound by this conscious method, we set up these vibrations, which in turn draw to the center of our nature and cause a correction in the atmosphere. A great saint once said, the deeper your realization of God, the more you have the power to control the weather and the environment around you. The deeper your realization in God, the more you have the power to correct and control the environment around you. So great saints have done this. They have actually shifted the course of the planetary system by their thought and their realization in God. And if they can do that, and they don't say it's a magic, and they tell us we can do it, then it behooves us to understand the principle and work it. It's just like somebody talking about driving a car, and you can take classes in driving, but until you get behind the wheel and take over the responsibility of obeying the rules of driving, you'll never drive that car. You'll always be afraid of it. But once you accept that responsibility and the mutual relationship of working with it, then you can drive that car without fear. Then driving will become a second nature to you. Equally true, the laws of consciousness governing matter and energy are around us too. And they are simple and direct. You just got to obey it. So here we are confronted with cataclysmic conditions. We have a choice to panic to offset, to prepare, and work through it. But we don't have to evade it. The planet is not 7 billion years old and it won't destroy itself. It's not going to turn into a sun. It takes a planet to change into a sun at the age of 7 billion years old. We're already 4.5 billion years old and we've got a long way yet to go to turn into a sun. We're going to see many incarnations of great masters and many cataclysms long ahead waiting for this particular planet. So what we got to realize is that there are always going to be conditions facing the planet as it moves through the atmosphere. And we rephrase that statement, as it moves through the atmosphere. We don't live in an atmosphere. We live in an atmosphere. As the planet moves through the atmosphere and other heavenly bodies or terrestrial bodies or celestial bodies break up and crash in on a headlong course towards us, we will be always confronted with these forces. Yet the entity life on the planet can, by virtue of love, by virtue of concentration and devotion, offset these waves. So, scriptural knowledge is not theory. It's valid science in the right hands of the right person at the helm of it. Otherwise, we'll all panic. And if you read the book of Revelation, when the four horsemen of the apocalypse went to the city, you ever found out which one killed the most people? Pestilence, panic, death, famine. Which one of the four killed the most people? Panic killed the most people. And this can happen in any place where man lives, because man is the only creature who can seem to control panic. His environmental training puts him in a handicap. And out of that training, he's also given the opportunity to learn to survive. Though you're handicapped by your environmental training, it's the same environmental training that can help you to survive. So don't fear, don't panic. Go cautiously through the time field with the right attitude and you can come out. That's what they mean, right thinking. If you can find 10 right thinking men, it won't destroy the city. It will not destroy its own self by suicidal action. When we find ourselves confronted with pressures like these, we have to draw into our own inner resources and center our mind and work through it. But enough of the gory details of existence. Now let us get on with the fact of how we can walk out this quagmire in faith and confidence and face the karmic debt. Remember, we are responsible for it too. It just doesn't happen to us. There are no happenings in the universe. They're all cause and effect. All law of cause and effect. We trigger these forces by virtue of our negative thinking. All around us we see creation in the form of matter, energy, and consciousness, and being. The four builders of the universe. When we use the energy wrong by the thinking we apply, we have the result of a cataclysmic action. That is what we have to face and live through. When we apply the correct thinking upon the energy around us, the manifestation is one of construction, uplifting. Therefore, in a summation, in your scriptural writing, they merely said, as a man thinketh in his heart, that is what he is. Thinking triggers off a tremendous amount of energy in this atmosphere. The psychic energy, the biophysical energy, is being triggered off by our thought waves. Man is the only creature whose brain is capable of triggering subatomic energy. Animals cannot do that. The human brain is the only brain designed to trigger subatomic energies. These subatomic energies are devastating, very instantaneous. They can produce remarkable cures in the body, and at the same time they can produce tremendous cataclysms in the universe. When they're applied incorrectly, we have a whole host of cataclysmic action. When they're applied correctly, we have a whole host of reproductive harmonious balance. It is up to us to understand these laws and work with them. Meditation is one of the bases or springboard for balancing the brain and centering it to allow these forces to flow through in a normal state to control our environment. When the emotions are fired up by fear, by anger, consciousness can seem to control it. And therefore, we are at a tremendous handicap by these forces. When we learn to balance it, and organize it, and work with it, then these forces are our servants. It is insufficient to produce and direct and give out spiritual theory without practicality. And that is one of the things we have to realize in our daily life. We have to combine common practicality with spiritual theory. And therefore, preparation is a necessary measure to back up certain concepts, certain prophecies or ideas that are perceived or precognized before they occur. Now, we are not too going to panic because the planet is always going to be threatened by prophecies. We don't have to wait till a prophecy hits us smack into our face. We can have a simple hurricane put out all the utilities in the community for 4 or 5 days and put us on a ration basis. This has happened to us and it will continue to happen and it will increase in density and capacity. Not too long ago, I was in Virginia, in the Richmond area. And when I arrived, 2-3 days before I arrived there, the weather had put that city on a basis of ration. We couldn't take it back because the water was polluted. And we have people who live there who can vouch for it, what the situation could have led to if there were not sufficient foresight. Panic would have crept in and the people were grabbing the food off the supermarket shelves because they had it kept up. You couldn't get the stuff to come in. The waters were high and the bridges were down. And they wouldn't let you drive in or drive out. Now, when a city is cut off by its bridges, airplanes aren't sufficient enough to drop food in. So what does the public do? What does man do when he knows he can't eat? fair tonic. Your best friend might kill you for the food on the plate. This is human nature. We don't realize what a tremendous force this is when a man is faced with hunger, when he's faced with violence and pestilence around him, because he is irrational. The brain is not stable. The intensity of that fear can cause him to be irrational. And that's not criminal. It's merely the fact that the brain cannot take the pressure. It has no relief valve built into it. We are having more and more mental cases. Pain control researches are going on all over this country now in ways to find relief. But if we don't have the right attitude to organize ourselves to live, to handle pain, we will be at the mercy of pain. We have already programmed ourselves to fear pain. The person who has the slightest pain, to show you that he's afraid of it, he will go and get some kind of a chemical to deaden the effect, but never removing the cause of the pain. But he will deaden the effect of the pain. Now, the way nature has us organized as a living mechanism, we need that pain, otherwise you would not put it there. Pain is not a bad thing. Pain is a teacher, and a very important thing. It will save your life. When you understand how pain operates in the human body, you can use it for the first time to develop your willpower. If you don't know how it operates, you can't develop your willpower. Anytime you deaden pain by some tranquilizing effect, by shutting it out, in order to avoid it or evade it, the willpower gets weak. It cannot cope. It cannot draw on the natural life power, the primal energy in your body, to offset the condition that is causing the pain. Before you know it, you have to take stronger and stronger dosages of medication to offset the effect of the pain. When you raise your mentality and your understanding